The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Now that the Taliban are back in power in Afghanistan, how will they rule? And who exactly is in charge?
This, until very recently, has been a clandestine organization. You don't know the who's who until they tell you, and they tell you very little.
And in the chaos at Kabul's airport, many Afghans are successfully getting on flights.
They were cheering, they were clapping, they were happy that plane just took off.
And Alexander Vindman was at the center of President Trump's first impeachment trial.
I didn't think the president was above the law. This is a country of laws, and I did what I thought was right, which is reporting him.
Some call him a hero, others a traitor. Also ahead, lots of rain in Greenland. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. After more scenes of chaos and panic at the airport in Kabul, President Biden addressed the American public today.
There'll be plenty of time to criticize and second guess when this operation is over. But now, I'm focused on getting this job done.
Biden said U.S. forces on the ground in Afghanistan are working to speed up the evacuation process.
This is one of the largest, most difficult airlifts in history. And the only country in the world capable of projecting this much power on the far side of the world with this degree of precision is the United States of America.
But the security situation is tense, to say the least, as the world's Shirin Jafari reports.
This video posted online Wednesday shows a group of girls singing a beloved Afghan song about their homeland. "Now that I've lost you, my dear country," they sing, "I'm forever burdened with sadness." The girls can't be seen in the footage, only their long shadows cast on the runway at Kabul's only international airport. Since last Sunday, when the Afghan government fell to the Taliban, the airport has become the only way out of the country for thousands of Afghans trying to flee. It's also been the scene of immense tragedy. Videos posted online show desperate people running alongside a U.S. military plane, some of them clinging to its landing gear. The plane takes off. Two men fall to their deaths. One of them was a young soccer player. Those Afghans who do make it out say they consider themselves lucky. Ramin Rahman is a 27-year-old photographer who says he has no doubt that he would have been targeted if he stayed.
I am working with a lot of media. My face is there. I've wrote a lot of articles about a lot of things, which made me feel that my life is in danger.
Rahman has been working for German news organizations for the past 3 years. On Monday morning, he got a call from one of his friends in Germany who told him to get to the airport immediately. The friend had put Rahman's name on the list for an evacuation flight for German embassy staff in Kabul. Rahman could only grab two things, his cell phone and laptop, before rushing to the airport.
A lot of people were panicking. They were running here and there. No police was there, no military, nothing.
Worst of all, he says, when he finally made it inside, there was no German flight.
Time passed and it was nighttime that I received another call that they are not coming. They are starting their evacuation from tomorrow, not tonight.
Rahman decided to sit tight at the airport. It was too risky to leave. The Taliban were on the streets outside. There were clashes at the entrance of the airport. Besides, he wasn't sure if he'd be able to get back in if he left. Hours passed. At around 11 p.m., he says, an American military plane landed. People rushed to get on board.
It was so difficult times for anyone. So many people were on that planes and so many people were get wounded, get injured. People step on each other. A lot of women were crying, kids were crying. It was horrible moments. I don't want to remember it. I don't want to... never.
At first, the Americans said the plane couldn't take off. There were too many people on board. Some had to get off. Rahman started to make his way out, but suddenly the sound of gunfire came closer.
They told me to stay there because they're feeling threats.
Threats because there was shooting close by. Rahman says he couldn't see outside of the plane, but he could hear the gunfire.
Then I feel hopeless that, okay, I'm gonna die here now.
An hour and 20 minutes later, he says the plane started moving. He finally felt a sense of relief and says his fellow passengers were ecstatic.
They were cheering, they were clapping, they were happy that plane just took off.
Rahman is now staying at a military base in the Gulf country of Qatar. He says there are thousands of people there just evacuated from Afghanistan. He's glad he made it out alive, but he says his parents and five siblings are still in Afghanistan. He says he worries about their safety and hopes to get them out soon.
That report from the world's Shirin Jafari, who's on the line with me now. Shirin, you were just at the Kabul airport earlier this month. How surprising is it to see the scenes playing out there now?
Carol, it's just so surreal to watch what is happening. I think nobody expected to see these images and videos that are coming out of Afghanistan now. When I was there, the airport was, you know, functional. There was a sense of order. Flights were taking off and landing. And to see what is happening right now is just so devastating for so many Afghans.
And you did some reporting at the airport, correct?
Yes, I spent the day there because, ironically, I was working on a story about security at the airport once the U.S. forces leave. And as part of my reporting, I got to speak with the top man for security at the airport.
Yeah, my name is General Riaz Aryan. I'm working as a border commander of airport since...
General Riaz Aryan was the top commander at Kabul airport until just a few days ago.
Oh, yeah, please.
Thank you so much for taking the time to
speak
with me. When we met at his office at the airport, he was in his military uniform and there was this big picture of former President Ashraf Ghani behind him on the wall. An Afghan flag was right there too.
Wow. So at that time, what did he tell you about his plans for security at the airport once the U.S. forces left?
General Aryan was very careful with his answers. He admitted that it would be a new experience for him and his team, but he said he was confident that the Afghans can manage.
But of course, everything changed so fast, and now the Taliban is in control of the country and the capital city.
Yeah, I think just like any leader, Carol, General Aryan wanted to project this sense of confidence. Interestingly, at the time, he also told me that he has no plans to leave Afghanistan. In fact, he said he had an opportunity a few years ago to move to France with his family, but he changed his mind at the last minute.
If you had the same visa and your family had the same visa now, would you make the same decision?
Yeah, I will have same decision. I'm proud to live in Afghanistan and serve our people as a general of Afghanistan.
So, Shirin, I have to ask the obvious question. Is this Afghan general still in Afghanistan?
So since Monday, I've been trying to get in touch with him on WhatsApp. And just a few minutes ago, he responded and I got to talk to him.
Yeah, I'm safe. And the first day when the Taliban came, I was in the airport until 11 o'clock of the night.
Carol, he told me that by Tuesday, he realized that it was just too dangerous for him to stay.
You know, there was one of my American friends in the airport, so he helped me a lot.
So he has left the country. I won't say where he is now for his safety, but it sounds like this is a very difficult time for him.
Wow, it's an amazing story. The world's Shirin Jafari, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
As you heard, it was only a few weeks ago that Shirin was in Afghanistan. Find more of her stories, including reporting from the Kabul airport. Look for us on Instagram, theworld.org/Instagram. It's said that conquering is the easy part. Governing is what's hard. And there are a lot of people wondering how exactly the Taliban will govern Afghanistan. Kamran Bohari has thought a lot about this. He's the director of analytical development for the New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy in Washington. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Bohari.
Kamran, can you start off by telling us what the organizational structure of the Taliban has looked like over the past 20 years?
So we don't really have an org chart as to what the inside of the Taliban looks like, and for good reason, in the sense that this, until very recently, has been a clandestine organization. You don't know the who's who until they tell you, and they tell you very little. So we have known that there are leadership committees or councils called the Shura. Shura means consultation. And then in the last decade, a Politburo emerged in the Qatari capital of Doha. This is what a political, if you will, office that the Taliban established as an interface with the outside world. And so it's a hodgepodge of different factions, for lack of a better term. By and large, the group stuck together, even though it was nebulous.
There was one Taliban senior leader who was quoted as saying the country may be governed through a ruling council, that idea that you raised of the Shura Council. What could that possibly look like?
So that's sort of the million-dollar question. If in a best-case scenario there was a negotiated settlement, you would still end up with something that's a Sunni-Afghan version of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the reason for that is that the Taliban are an ideological group controlled by mullahs and commanders. This is not a political party or even a social movement, if you will.
Things in Kabul obviously are still in their early days, so only time will tell what this Taliban will actually do. I mean, one of the big questions on everyone's mind is how much of the leadership from that previous time when the Taliban ruled brutally in the 1990s, how much of that iron fist will be duplicated by this new Taliban government? What do you think?
There is a leadership that has learned to be diplomatic. There is a leadership that has learned PR. There is a leadership that has traveled around the world and realized that there's a way to govern and to deal with the real world. There's a minority leadership at the top that is sensitive to that pragmatism. But the bulk of the movement, as I said earlier, is heavily ideological and or just doesn't know how to behave in a different way. They're fueled by the euphoria of religion and nationalism mixed together. And so how do they deal with the outside world? Because they need money. They're not going to run this state based on their existing resources, which come from criminal enterprises and drug dealing. It's going to be a tough challenge. And a lot of this is why you're already beginning to see the disconnect between what their spokesmen are saying on TV and what their soldiers, their foot soldiers, are doing around the country.
You remarked earlier on how the Taliban are saying inclusivity a lot in their rhetoric. How do you interpret that, though? Could that include former government officials?
I think so. There's word from Pakistan where this is sort of all being sort of choreographed, or at least that's the bulk of the back channel conversations that are happening to shape the new Emirate 2.0. What you hear, and I'm hearing it from my sources, is that the Pakistani security establishment, who have links to the Taliban, have come up with a list of sorts that are recommendations for people who are from the anti-Taliban camp to be included in this new government. To what extent the Taliban actually include them or cross out certain names from that list and add their own names, people who are not Taliban and who've been allies with them, who knows? You know, that's something we'll just have to wait and see.
Kamran, you drew a couple of parallels for Taliban rule, a version of Iran and its clerics, a possible emirate. Do you know, though, if the Taliban are relying on an actual historical blueprint for modeling their new government?
The rumor intelligence is that there is some effort to sort of look at the 1964 constitution of Afghanistan, which was intended to be more democratic because it was supposed to take the monarchy or the monarchical regime at the time led by King Zahir Shah to make it more inclusive, to have a better way of dealing with sort of a decentralized nature of the country. It didn't go too far because in 73, King Zahir Shah was overthrown by his cousin, who then turned the country into a republic. And then he ruled for 5 years before he was booted out by the only organized group in the country at the time, which was the Communist Party. And then the war began, and that's been a 40-year war ever since.
Kamran Bokhari with the New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy in Washington. He's also a national security and foreign policy specialist with the University of Ottawa's Professional Development Institute. Kamran, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Coming up, an update from an Afghan hiding in Kabul. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. During the first impeachment trial of former President Trump, National Security Council member Alexander Vindman was a central witness. He listened in on that now infamous phone call between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, the one where Trump pressured the Ukrainian president to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Vindman reported his concerns up the chain of command, then found himself testifying before Congress and addressing his father in his opening remarks.
Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman's new book is titled Here, Right Matters, An American Story. He recently spoke with my colleague, Marco Werman.
Alexander Vindman, we just heard you testifying to Congress and focusing your remarks to your dad. You write in your book that your father did not want you to testify. In fact, it was kind of a point of tension between you two. Why did he not want you to testify and why ultimately did you?
My family dynamic involves points of tension with our dad kind of disagreeing with him on politics and certain things of that nature. A common thread between immigrants from failed communist regimes where the pendulum swings him to an unhealthy brand of conservatism. But when he spoke to me about the dangers involving challenging the president, it was from his decades of experience and a deep understanding of power and how power works. Harking back to his time in the Soviet Union, where the consequences would be much more severe.
Well, family is central to you and your story. So let's back up to the beginning. You were born in Ukraine in 1975. Your father took you, your two brothers, and your grandmother in 1979 to the U.S. At a certain point, your older brother, Len, joins the U.S. military, as did your brother, Eugene. You also decided to take that path. What drew you to the military?
Well, I think for us, our older brother set the template. We were highly energetic kids, and by watching our older brother start in ROTC and then enlist, we tried to emulate him. And when he was going for runs or climbing ropes and all that kind of stuff, we did the same thing and very quickly settled on going into university and ROTC, some service to repay this country. And, you know, it sounds kind of a little bit hokey, but we did actually think about it in those terms.
So you joined the U.S. Army. Tell me about your deployment to Iraq. That was 2004. You were in Fallujah, some of the toughest fighting the U.S. military has ever been involved with. I know you learned a big lesson there about letting down your guard, and I want to know how that lesson came into play some years later. First of all, what happened in Iraq, the incident with the IED and the bicycle?
You know, this was early days in the deployment, relatively soon after the war started, not very long after at all, actually. And within the first month or so, we were committed to Phantom Fury, the second fight for Fallujah, the largest urban fight that the U.S. military had engaged in since Vietnam. In preparation for that, we were conducting a reconnaissance. And on this patrol, while we were driving around the battlefield, my convoy was struck by a particularly nasty kind of improvised explosive device, one that was designed to punch through armor. At the time, you know, new to combat, there was a phrase that was rattling around my mind, the absence of the normal or the presence of the abnormal, which is something that I would retain with me through my service as an attaché in Russia or in the White House, for that matter, looking for markers that something is off. And one of the other lessons I learned from this is, frankly, that I was trainable and I reacted in a cool, calm, collected manner to being hit by an IED. You know, I remember the cabin and the Humvee filling up with smoke, but very, very quickly collecting myself, assessing my counterparts were injured. The driver was the only one that was completely uninjured, and that we were still in the middle of a potential fight and that I had a job to do. So It was a good early test of my military training.
So fast forward to 2019, Fiona Hill, Trump's Russia specialist, hires you to serve on the NSC. So now you're working for the White House. Then on July 25th, 2019, the so-called perfect phone call between Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky, the former TV comedian who'd just become a president of Ukraine. Tell us where you were in the White House at the time and the part you played in that call.
So it was the White House Situation Room. We were focused on an intercom, listening to a phone call that I was extremely apprehensive about. And as soon as the president came online, not only was it not going to advance U.S. national security interests, but when the president went into his quid pro quo when he said, I'd like you to do us a favor, though. He was attacking both U.S. national security and putting us in a position where Ukraine would be more vulnerable, easier for Russia to draw into its orbit, and therefore Russia would pose a much more potent adversary to the U.S. with Ukraine. And at the same time, attacking the U.S. domestically by undermining free and fair elections, the very foundation of how our system works.
So taking that lesson from your deployment to Iraq in 2004, be alert to both the absence of normal as well as the presence of the abnormal. Did you sense either of those prior to that phone call? How much of was that call a surprise to you?
I had a very good idea of what was happening behind the scenes. I was stubborn in thinking that these were maybe folks looking to ingratiate themselves with the president, people looking to do the president's bidding, but without, you know, the president's knowledge and forethought. I thought that might have been the case. And of course, once the president had vocalized this, it became abundantly clear to me, something that I couldn't kind of just set aside based on the fact that I'm an army officer and the commander in chief was the one that was failing to live up to his oath to the Constitution and threatening our democracy. I couldn't deny that anymore. And I didn't think the president was above the law. This is a country of laws. And I did what I thought was right, which is reporting him.
After you testified in the impeachment hearing, many Trump supporters and certain corners of the media started a smear campaign against you. You were called a traitor. You were even accused of being a Ukrainian spy. How personal did it get?
I mean, for them, there was no kind of limit. What's interesting is that it was the president's press office that generated those attack points. And then, of course, those have been reverberating for the years since. But their personal attacks don't have an impact on me, frankly. I have, in fact, felt a lot of support from my colleagues and peers, Americans that reached out and passed letters of support or emails. And then you have these kind of anonymous tweets or something of that nature that are attacking me. It's easy to kind of separate what really matters, put it in perspective. The rest of it is background noise.
Well, those forces that smeared you after your testimony are still very much alive in the U.S., and many feel the undermining of American democracy continues after the Trump years. You're in the academic sphere these days, Alexander Vindman, thinking about all of this. What occurs to you about the way forward to preserving the values that this country represented, like to your father when he brought you and the rest of your family here back in 1979?
You know, it's interesting. There have been probably brief moments where my confidence has wavered, but largely it's remained unshaken. And that's probably because of perspective on where my family's come from. But at the same time, we're missing something that could help bring us together. And that's accountability. That's accountability of public officials that failed to live up to their responsibilities. And that's accountability of media personalities that see profit in attacking the United States. Accountability is one of the passages we need to pass through in order to get back to unity and keep this country strong.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman speaking with my colleague Marco Werman. His new book is Here, Right Matters, An American Story. You're with the world. China has a large fleet of fishing boats in the South China Sea, but they're not just out there fishing.
Some of their craft have hidden on board large machine guns.
In response, Vietnam is building up its own maritime force with encouragement from Washington. We'll tell you what they're doing ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 20 years ago, American forces entered Afghanistan with a broad coalition of NATO allies. This afternoon, President Biden said that cooperation continues as the mission in Afghanistan winds down.
For 20 years, Afghanistan has been a joint effort with our NATO allies. We went in together, and we're leaving together. And now we're working together to bring our people and our Afghan partners to safety.
Konstanz Stelzenmüller at the Brookings Institution has been following the European reaction to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Konstanz, what's your reaction to President Biden's message earlier this afternoon?
I think that Biden's words about Afghan allies and European allies are welcome, but they're a bit late. It's Friday now. All of this happened on Sunday, and that did a great deal of damage. The seeming lack of empathy, both for the Afghans in mortal peril in Kabul and elsewhere, many of whom have worked not just with American forces, but with European forces, including those of my own country, Germany, and, of course, European allies whose nationals were also left stranded in Kabul and whom European governments are now scrambling to get out.
You say it's done damage, but what kind of damage? What's the fallout from this for Germany and other European allies?
So let me make a caveat here. I think that Europeans and Germans have made all sorts of mistakes in combination both with the 20 years of the Afghan mission and with a pullout. And we're not, I think, criticizing the decision to draw down American troops, although I think there was an argument to be made to say that actually a minimal presence would have been feasible. I personally, having reported out of Afghanistan myself, tend in that direction. But okay, it's an acceptable decision. It is the way it was made, it was the way it was communicated, and the way it was implemented that I think has concerned and, I think in some cases, offended European allied policymakers and publics.
There's some talk that European allies are not only offended, but there's a sense that they've been kind of betrayed. I mean, does it go that far?
Honestly, I think betrayal is a deeply unhelpful word here. I think that in the urgency of such decisions, mistakes are made, and what counts is how you repair them. And I do think that Biden's remarks today go some way to making that possible, to opening the door for that. But the truth is also that NATO was sidelined. NATO, which after all, I mean, let's not forget why we are in Afghanistan. It is because on September 12th, the European allies in NATO invoked Article 5, the Mutual Assistance Clause of the NATO Treaty, to come to America's aid because of the attacks of 9/11. That is why we are there. That is why we have been at America's side all the time. And NATO was sidelined this week. The EU was practically absent. All that is, I think, tragic and presents an image of Western disunity that concerns me far more than talk of betrayal, which I think is really exaggerating it.
What is this new reality on the ground in Afghanistan? What does it mean for Europe?
Well, that's a good question. There is clearly, from what European political leaders are saying, an enormous concern that there might be yet another massive migratory movement in the direction of Europe. And this is of concern specifically for Germany and for France. The Germans have a national election on September 26th, and the French have a presidential election next spring. I would remind Americans and Europeans that despite the fact that we Germans took in over 1 million refugees in 2015 and 2016, most of them from Syria, and although we struggled to integrate them into German society, and although there was great political turmoil over this, 5 years later, very few bad things have happened. And most of them, I think, are quite well integrated and are members of German society and the German workforce. This is actually, in retrospect, gone remarkably well.
My last question is, what does this past week do to America's image in the world, especially in Europe?
And I think you're implicitly asking what so many of us, which is this damaging to America's credibility? I'm not sure that that is really what the world is seeing or what Europeans are seeing. I think what we're seeing is an America and an American administration that is so besieged by its domestic issues, so worried and concerned about its internal divisions, that it increasingly has little real bandwidth for the world outside. And I think one shouldn't underestimate the empathy that your friends have for you, because we are undergoing similar internal divisions. But it's distressing to see it happen in America. And I think many of us would like to help. And many of us, I think, have also been forcefully brought to the understanding in this past week that we really do need to do more for our own security because of this bandwidth problem in America.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where she's also the Fritz Stern Chair on German and Transatlantic Relations. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, as always, Carol. Be well.
Now we have an update on a story we brought you earlier in the week about what's happening in Afghanistan. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
On Monday, we spoke with a young Afghan man who worked with the U.S. Army. He wanted us to just call him Mo to protect his identity. We called him back today, and he said, use my full name.
Hey, how are you? Not Mo. Mo is Muhammad Azim Nizad.
Muhammad Azim Nizad made it to the Kabul airport and to safety. He says he's not afraid of the Taliban anymore. We reached him at the Kabul airport on a shaky phone connection.
I'm so happy today. I feel very good.
Nizad worked for 6 years with U.S. Army Special Forces removing landmines. He later became a radio DJ with the U.S., engaged in propaganda and psychological warfare targeting the Taliban. Nizad says the Taliban threatened to kill him numerous times and that his car was ambushed as recently as last month. Last week, Nizad traveled from Afghan province to province, staying a step ahead of the Taliban. When he spoke with us on Monday, he said he made it to Kabul, where he was holed up in a locked room stocked with food. He told us he was afraid to go to the airport.
This is very risky for me. If I go to the airport, there's a lot of Taliban. If I take my documents that I work with the U.S. Army, if I go outside, there's the Taliban and there's the checkpoints of Taliban. They will check my cell phones and also they'll check my all documents. How can I go to the airport?
Then on Wednesday, Nizad had a change of heart and decided to make a break for it.
Because I was thinking a lot about that if I stay, I cannot stay for a long time in one house. Like, I can stay for 1 month, I can stay for 2 months, but I cannot stay for a long time in my house.
You could say he then outsmarted the Taliban. Nizad said he was monitoring the situation in Kabul through social media.
After that, I decided that I will go and I make this planning, that I will not take any documents with myself, and I will not take anything in my cell phone.
With his phone wiped clean and no documents identifying him as having worked with the American military, the Taliban let him pass on by.
I mean, nobody at that time know that this is Muhammad Azim Nizad.
At the airport, he says he waited outside for 37 hours. When he finally got to the front of the line, he downloaded documents from the Google Cloud proving he worked with the American military. He also had his passport with him. Nizad showed all of this to American authorities, who waved him in.
Now we are safe. Everyone that they come to the airport, inside the airport, they are safe.
Nizad is taking a military transport plane to Doha today. He'll be processed there, then, he says, relocated to the U.S. Where exactly, he doesn't yet know. On Monday, Nizad told us he felt left behind by the U.S. government, a nation he worked with clearing landmines and doing propaganda against the Taliban. Today, I asked him how he felt now.
I'm very appreciated. And thanks from U.S. government that they help those people that they work with U.S. Army, and they will not love, not left behind now. I am 100% sure. I hope, inshallah.
This story does have one very sad wrinkle. Muhammad Azim Nizad left behind his wife and young child. He said it was just too dangerous to bring them to the airport, with people being killed and injured outside the terminal, and hundreds of people pushing to get inside. He says once he's in the U.S., he'll send for his family. For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
This summer in Myanmar, a popular young rock star named Raymond died. It didn't make international headlines, but on Burmese social media, there was a huge outpouring of emotion. Just a reminder, it's now been 6 months since the military overthrew the democratically elected government in Myanmar. Millions of people poured into the streets to protest. The military responded with a swift and brutal crackdown that continues today. Reporter Naomi Gingold tells us the story of this musician, Raymond. His story encapsulates a lot of Myanmar's grief and anger.
The first big song Raymond ever recorded was actually not with his band Idiots, but with a hip-hop artist named Jamie. I heard this story several years ago. See, as a teenager, Raymond sang harmony with his mom. She was a backup singer then. And one day in the studio, Jamie heard Raymond sing and his jaw dropped open. Jamie asked if he would sing on his new project. And Jamie says he was so little, like the guitar was big on him. Soon after, Raymond started doing small shows with his band Idiots. Now, I spoke to many people for this story, but you're mostly going to hear me, not them. The crackdown is now too violent. The resistance underground extra attention, extra risky, especially if you're well-known or work in those circles. And the military is now going after family, friends, really anybody within striking distance. So the Idiots had a couple big songs before 2010, but it was the album they released in 2011 that cemented Raymond's superstardom across the country. One of their most famous songs is Sulat, or Prize. Oh, the light of the daytime meeting, then from a private room, my day. I'd get not happy, not happy, I'm gonna is just one of many Idiots songs you might hear kids strumming on a street corner on a nice day. Growing up, Raymond had a bit of a tough time. His parents got divorced when he was young. That can come with a lot of judgment in Myanmar. He struggled to make it in the industry, struggled financially. But he always joked around about the good and the bad. His motto was, try to live happy.
Just focus on making music and what they can create.
This is a friend of Raymond's who, for safety reasons, I'm not going to identify. In the song Nate Kadot, Raymond sings about leaving the bad things behind you, embracing the future. Raymond never released anything blatantly political, but he cared a lot. And in February, when the military seized power, it seemed like the country's growth, everyone's dreams.
But then suddenly, it's like all those things like disappear.
And in February, when the military seized power, millions erupted in protest, and Raymond was out front in Yangon, the biggest city. Here, Raymond and Idiots are singing with megaphones to tens of thousands gathered in protest in central Yangon. The song, by a different artist, is about doing what you believe in, even if it means sacrificing yourself. When the military started openly attacking with snipers, hunting people down, and the protests became more like street battles, Raymond was still out front. In April, the military started publishing almost daily lists, arrest warrants, for celebrities, then added journalists, activists, doctors, on and on. Raymond was on that very first list. He escaped into the jungle. The jungle is also now where many are training to fight with Burma's parallel civilian government. When his close friends first heard that he died in June from internal bleeding, they thought maybe it was a prank. Even people who didn't listen to Idiots respected Raymond as an artist and also genuinely humble person. And to many in the music world, Raymond was a little brother. When news spread, the outpour was especially fierce from young Burmese and musicians. And that matters. One, because right now, young Burmese are the core of the resistance movement. And two, because the arrest warrant lists and violence had mostly stopped artists from speaking out. But suddenly, they were very vocal. His death seemed to galvanize them. And everyone was so angry. If he were able to safely get healthcare, they said, he would be alive. And since his death, the military has weaponized healthcare even more, arresting doctors treating COVID, restricting who can get oxygen. In an interview from a couple years ago, Raymond explained that he'd told his girlfriend, I kind of want to get married, but in life, things don't always go as planned. Adding, we can't predict our destiny. Raymond was born in 1988, the year nationwide protests led to a brutal crackdown, elections, and a military coup. He died protesting the next coup. When the band was cleaning his house, they found a piece of paper where he'd written lyrics for an English language side project. The first verse reads, "Hello and goodbye, fear. You've infected me for years. Well, I won't be giving up, so you better give it up. Hello and goodbye, fear." The Idiots' latest album was nearly done when Raymond died. It'll be released posthumously. For The World, I'm Naomi Gingold.
This story comes to us from Not the Cat, a storytelling and news podcast about Asia. You work your entire life to hone the skills and athleticism to earn an Olympic medal. It gets a place of honor in your home, permanently on display for friends and family to admire. A constant reminder that you are one of the best in the world. Well, one Polish track and field athlete had an even better vision for her Olympic medal. 25-year-old Polish javelin thrower Maria Andrzejczyk auctioned the silver medal she won last month in Tokyo to raise money for a life-saving operation for an infant boy. A Polish family had been trying to raise money to pay for the baby to have a heart operation in the U.S. The new Olympic silver medalist wanted to help and auctioned off her new hardware for the cause. That auction raised $51,000 for the family. Fans threw in another $76,000 on top of that. The winning bidder for the silver medal? A Polish convenience store chain. They wrote a check and said Maria Andrzejczyk can keep her silver medal. Vice President Kamala Harris is heading to Asia for Singapore, then Vietnam on Tuesday. In Vietnam, she's expected to deliver this message. Washington is your partner in the South China Sea. More than one-third of global trade flows through these waters, and China says they claim pretty much all of it. Vietnam is one of several countries pushing back on that, but it isn't only being confronted by China's navy. Vietnam is also facing off against a mysterious Chinese fleet that, according to Beijing, doesn't even exist. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
It was an attempted manslaughter at sea, captured on video. This hulking steel ship with a Chinese flag bearing down on a smaller wooden boat full of Vietnamese fishermen. Watching it all happen were some Vietnamese civilians fishing nearby. One of them recorded the attack as his friend screamed helplessly. Soon, the boat was in splinters, the crew nearly drowned, and the attacking ship, it just took off over the blue horizon. Who on earth were they?
They're a paramilitary force recruited from among China's fishermen.
Carl Schuster is a former U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer, now a scholar with Hawaii Pacific University. And that Chinese paramilitary force, they're a little hard to explain. It's made up of former fishermen. They cruise in giant boats that have fishing gear, but they're actually military vessels.
They're generally armed with AK-47s, other small arms. Some of their craft have hidden on board large machine guns, 14.5 millimeter.
Those shoot bullets as big as carrots. But this Chinese maritime force hardly ever uses its firearms. They prefer fire hoses, which can blast a smaller boat's cabin.
One of two things happen. It either breaks the windows and injures the crew inside, knocks them down and bruises them up, or the cold water gets down into the engines and cracks the crankcase or does a lot of damage and leaves the boat helpless.
And if that doesn't work?
If that doesn't work, then they come up alongside and they bump them. And since they have a reinforced steel hull and their target's made of wood, they usually win.
Schuster, a former captain, has studied this Chinese force for years. Internally, it's called the People's Armed Forces Maritime Militia, and it keeps growing more aggressive. They roam the South China Sea, intimidating actual fishermen from Vietnam or the Philippines. And the message is always the same. These are Chinese waters. We belong here. You don't. That ramming incident, recorded 7 years ago, that was one of the first incidents caught on camera. But even when they are caught, Beijing always denies that these fishermen are under the control of China's navy, which Schuster says they definitely are.
If you do something to the maritime militia, China claims their fishermen are being victimized. It does a very good job of presenting an image of China as a victim.
Vietnam will sometimes deploy its Coast Guard to challenge these bogus fishermen. But then China can escalate, sending warships to even the score. That is a Chinese Coast Guard ship in 2014 ramming a Vietnamese Coast Guard boat. These are the most contentious waters in the world, and America is taking sides. A few weeks ago, U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin went to Southeast Asia, sitting down with Vietnam's military. And on that trip, he said this.
Beijing's claim to the vast majority of the South China Sea has no basis in international law. That assertion treads on the sovereignty of the states in the region.
States such as Vietnam. Vice President Kamala Harris will likely repeat that line when she flies to Hanoi next week. Moving forward, the U.S. plans to send its warships into the South China Sea at a higher tempo. But China's modern navy is no joke. It has aircraft carriers and island military bases, and they are well on their way to becoming the boss of that sea. Schuster says they're not going away.
In terms of making China back down from what they already have, I don't see that happening. That game's already lost.
So what can a much smaller country like Vietnam even do?
Lực lượng dân quân biển toàn tỉnh đã được tổ chức tinh gọn thành 5 trung đội ở 5 huyện thị xã ven biển.
As this report from Vietnam state media says, it's going to beef up a fisherman militia of its own. Vietnam is recruiting more fishermen for its auxiliary force, and Hanoi will soon spend nearly $500 million to give them souped-up fishing boats made not of wood but steel, so they will no longer get rammed to pieces, Schuster says.
Their purpose, as far as I can tell, is to be an immediate defense force in a tripwire.
Unlike China's maritime militia, these guys probably won't be picking many fights. They'll spend most of their time actually fishing. But they can act as scouts for Vietnam's Navy, which can even pass intel to the U.S. military. There is one other way Vietnam's maritime militia is different. Unlike Beijing, Hanoi admits that its fishermen militia actually exists. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
A new record this week, rain falling where rain doesn't normally fall, at the summit of Greenland's ice cap, a place that spends nearly all its time comfortably below freezing.
If you were there, you would have needed an umbrella.
An umbrella may not cut it. That was scientist Walt Meyer. His team estimated that 7 billion tons of rainwater fell on Greenland's ice sheet earlier this week. Meyer monitors weather on the ice cap with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado.
You know, we're seeing things happening that we humans haven't seen before.
The volume of rain that fell on Greenland is only an estimate because scientists have never had to measure rain there before. Jennifer Mercer is with the National Science Foundation's Office of Polar Programs.
When I was asked how much rain we received, I was in an interview with a couple of our researchers, and we sort of paused and thought, well, we don't know because we don't have any rain gauges on station. It's not something we ever expected to have to measure.
The warm weather that led to rain also led to ice melt. The combined effect will leave a permanent mark on Greenland's ice.
Our researchers won't know the true impacts of this rain event, probably for some time. It will create a record in the ice sheet that will be detectable in ice cores, you know, hundreds to thousands of years in the future, because it'll create a thick crust of ice that we can date to this year.
And if you're wondering if climate change has anything to do with this, Meyer at the Snow and Ice Data Center says yes.
The Arctic regions are more sensitive to climate change. That's something we've known for decades. So it's where we've expected to see change happen first and most dramatically initially. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
And it's not just rain and melting ice sheets.
The sea ice floating in the ocean is declining precipitously. Glaciers are melting. Permafrost is thawing. So this is, in a sense, just another data point.
A data point and also a drop in the bucket in a long trend of global warming.
It's a symbolic drop in the bucket, and it's kind of iconic of the change we've seen. The more important change is the long-term mass loss and the long-term warming that we've seen over the last three decades or so, and that we know is going to continue decades into the future.
Might be time to buy that umbrella. And that does it for this August Friday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here on Monday.